Big cuts could be on the way from Washington.
What would they mean for our budding economic recovery?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Adrian Hill in Los Angeles, in for Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, February 10th.
Coming up as earnings season continues, which companies are telling us the most about the state of the economy? Also, is the fanny pack back?
But first, let's get to the budget-cutting proposals that are coming out of Washington. A Republican plan that emerged yesterday would save $35 billion by eliminating dozens of federal programs and cutting funding for others. The proposal is already drawing criticism, and it's only the beginning of a fight that will go on for weeks.
Diane Swonk apparently wants to be in Washington for the beginning of that fight. She's chief economist at Mesirow Financial, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Yeah, I don't really like to listen to the politics around here. But anyways, here I am in Washington.
All right. Well, so $35 billion in cuts, maybe even more. A lot of Republicans want it to be a bigger cut, certain to be felt by all Americans. But how much would these cuts, if enacted, do to bring down the deficit?
Well, not very much. Unfortunately, much of the focus right now is on the minutia, on the short-term things that we deal with, anything from discretionary spending to, you know, cuts around the edges. The real elephant in the room is, of course, entitlement spending in our tax code. How can we make it better, and how can we really make the decisions about our spending more efficient? How do we get to the core of that? It's something that Ben Bernanke underscored. And right now, this is just sort of flirtations around the edges, focusing on, you know, the minutia instead of the big picture.
So you're saying that that lawmakers should just spend now and make cuts that wouldn't go into effect for years on things like Social Security and Medicare?
Well, I think we could phase in some major changes to entitlement spending that would be much easier for Americans to digest if they were phased in over time. And frankly, the world is looking to us not to cut around the edges of our budget, but deal with the structural budget problems we have, and that is an aging population that we've made promises to that we can't afford to keep those promises given the current tax revenues that we're taking in. And we need to deal with those issues, which are much harder on politically than the sort of cutting around the edges that we're seeing today.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
While we're in Washington, the congressional panel that oversees the $700 billion TARP rescue, it's released a report this morning on executive pay at bailed out financial institutions. The report says Ken Feinberg, the pay czar, or special master as he's called, successfully cut compensation but failed to make long-lasting changes to the Wall Street pay structure.
Former Democratic Senator Ted Kaufman chairs the Congressional Oversight Panel, and he joins us now. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So when Congress set up the bank bailout, members wanted to make sure that financial institutions were not going to use the bailout money to give out big bonuses and executive compensation. You've been looking into this. How'd they do?
They did okay. What the report found is that on the companies covered, the overall compensation fell by an average of 55%, and the maximum paid out was in the area of $500,000 in cash. In addition to that, they did move more to stock from cash.
So that there's a long-term incentive to make sure that deals are good.
Right.
There are a lot of people, including a number of people in Congress, who get pretty queasy when they think about the government setting pay levels at private institutions. What would you say to those people?
Wherever you are on the ideological spectrum, you've got to believe that if, in fact, you take federal government money, then you are going to have to abide by their rules. But I do think that most people believe, and I believe, that executive compensation's gotten out of hand.
But you think we missed an opportunity with the strings that were attached to the TARP?
What we had hoped for and what the special master had hoped for was that this was going to be a model. But it doesn't look like it's going to turn out the way most of the experts think, that this had a modest impact. And the reason for this was that there is a lack of complete transparency in how the special master reached his opinions. It's awful hard to replicate what he did if you don't know the details of what it is that that he did.
Former Senator Ted Kaufman, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's always a pleasure.
New legislation in Washington state has electric vehicle enthusiasts all charged up, but not in a good way. The bill would tax EV drivers for the gasoline they don't use. From the Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Gasoline taxes pay for road maintenance and repair, but cash-poor states are beginning to worry about dwindling road funds as more drivers go electric. Today, a Washington State Senate committee considers a bill that would make EV drivers pay $100 a year. That would make up for the gas taxes they won't pay. Stephen Lowe is with the Seattle Electric Vehicle Association. He says any special fee on electric cars is just one more roadblock to their adoption.
Some people are paying from $1,000 to $2,000 to have their garage wired up for these higher power charging infrastructures. Another $100 is just, some people are going to say, forget it.
Lowe's group may push instead for an electric car tax that's based on miles driven every year instead of a flat fee. That would probably end up costing EV drivers less. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Well, the Super Bowl may be over, but there's a big football showdown on the way between NFL team owners and players. The league's collective bargaining agreement expires next month. And later today, the NFL Players Association will be warning about the economic effects of any lockout. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
The NFL brings a lot of money to a lot of different businesses. There's billions in ad revenue at stake for TV networks, hundreds of millions in ticket sales. Then there's the merchandising. Take Electronic Arts' wildly popular Madden NFL video games. EA's scored more than $3 billion on the Madden game franchise, and a lockout would shut that down.
Every year, they're putting out a new video game that has all of the updated players with their teams and their skill sets.
Robert Bauman is a sports economist at College of the Holy Cross. He says fantasy football would also get spiked, and that industry has become an online advertising mammoth.
Depending on whose numbers you believe and what you want to count as a fantasy football dollar, you could be getting up into the billions, certainly.
An estimated $5 billion. But Bauman says the little guy would take the biggest hit. He says restaurants, hotels, parking lots, and other small businesses that cater to football fans would bear the biggest economic loss of a football lockout. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, February 10th. I'm Adrian Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Now let's get to the global perspective. What's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world? Adrian, I'm here in New York, which is currently home base for the New York Stock Exchange, but maybe not for long.
That's right. The parent company of the Frankfurt Stock Exchange is in talks to buy the NYSE. This comes just a day after the London Stock Exchange announced a merger with the owner of the Toronto Stock Exchange. It's exchange mergers everywhere. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
On stock exchanges, there are fewer traders shouting orders. Investing has gone high tech. The hum of computers punctuated by typing. And that's got the New York Stock Exchange worried about losing relevance and business. But the London Capital Group's Angus Campbell says there's more to these mergers than technology.
It's not only from a sort of IT perspective that it makes sense to merge with other exchanges, but also competition is becoming pretty fierce.
Bigger exchanges make it simpler for traders to do business faster. David Buick is a trader with BGC. He says they want to attract investors from around the world.
This is the way forward, and if you're going to take on all the BRIC countries, the Far East, and have a truly global stock exchange, you have to be very cost-conscious and very commission-conscious.
If this deal goes through, New York will still be a financial capital, but David Buick says to watch out for markets from Bombay to Shanghai. Singapore's exchange is close to a merger with one in Australia. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Thousands of shipping and canal workers along the Suez Canal in Egypt aren't working. They're pushing for better pay and housing. The sit-in hasn't disrupted shipments yet, but it could. Some of the countries most concerned are those who depend on imports for their energy. This week, Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in Jordan, one of the Middle East's oil-poor countries. He joins us now from Amman. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Adrian.
So how has the crisis affected Jordan's energy supplies?
It's cut one of its most important energy arteries. Last week, there was an explosion in a natural gas pipeline between Egypt and Jordan, which it uses to generate about 60% of its electricity. Here's a former Jordanian energy minister, Khaled Irani.
It might be around $3 million a day, the extra cost of shifting to heavy fuel and diesel. And if it stayed for a week or a month, that is very significant.
Now, Jordan just cannot afford an extra $100 million a month, especially since the crisis has hit the country's crucial tourist industry and it's losing revenues of $50 million a day.
It's really amazing. With the whole region in turmoil the way it is now, what does it mean for the stability of Jordan?
This is a critical question. Jordan is a key American ally in this region. Like most countries in the Middle East, Jordan's been trying to buy off its disaffected population by subsidizing everything from food to fuel. These extra costs are going to make it a lot harder to do that.
Stephen Beard and Aman Jordan. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Adrian.
A message now to the nation's school children. Be careful what you wish for. In Haywood County, North Carolina, students probably went to bed on a stormy Monday night, Adrian, wishing for a snow day on Tuesday.
And we know how that feels.
Exactly.
So
we've all been there listening to the radio, waiting for them to announce your school district. Well, those kids in Haywood County, they got their snow day. And now, in order to avoid having to make up the missed day this summer, the Haywood County School District says class will be in session this Saturday.
Boo!
Seems pretty cruel to me, although I think the Tiger Moms out there are probably pretty happy about it.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, February 10th. I'm Adrian Hill.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. You can always give us your feedback by going to marketplace.org and clicking on the link that says Contact. Well, you may have noticed we are in the middle of corporate earnings season. It happens every few months. Public companies tell us how they did last quarter and how they expect to do in the coming year. Today, for example, Pepsi said profits fell last quarter because of higher commodity costs. Well, to make sense of all the numbers that are coming in, let's bring in Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jeremy.
So we're getting earnings from everyone, from McDonald's to Northrop Grumman. What companies should we be paying attention to get a good idea of how the economy's doing?
I would pay attention to UPS, the brown trucks. It's a bellwether. Packages delivered everywhere. Fourth quarter earnings up 48%. I mean, this is a stunning number. And then if you look at the holiday season, and this is why I really love earnings reports, they delivered 440 million packages. And what this signaled is the online retailing world has truly taken off. It gives us an indication of what our economy is doing and where it's going.
All right. So shipping, that's an important one. What else are you looking at?
Well, we know that we shored up the banking system, right? Because of the big banks collapse, we'd have a lot of economic trouble. Well, Wells Fargo is doing much better. And if you look at their earnings report, here's the thing that I liked. Wells Fargo was doing pretty well across the board in its loans, but it's highlighting that it believes the real opportunity is in commercial loans. And that's what we really want to see, some business borrowing.
All right. So shipping, finance, two important sectors of the economy. You seem pretty optimistic about both. How about a third for good luck?
This is, I guess, the optimistic couple of minutes here. We're going to Emerson Electric. You know, the manufacturing sector is doing well. And I listened to the webcast after their earnings, and they're saying that the wind is to our back. But here's the other thing. They emphasized inflation. They are seeing big increases in material prices, and they're really worried about inflation going forward.
And that's something that a lot of companies are worried about, whether it be food companies or energy companies. Marketplace Economics correspondent Chris Farrell, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Fashion Week begins today in New York. Those pricey catwalk designs are out of reach for most of us, but cheap copycat versions could be available in no time. So a proposed law aims to copyright clothing designs. That, some legal experts say, could be a fashion don't. Janet Babin reports.
Designer Nanette Lepore has held dozens of fashion shows, but she says it's always a mad dash to the catwalk.
We're still scrambling. We're behind, and I'm panicked.
About 130 people work at her garment district studio. For the show, she's mocking up a blouse with bias-cut sleeves.
So we're into, like, playing with bias again, which always makes me nervous that we keep harking back to the 1930s since that was our Depression-era clothing.
Lepore's business was flat last year. This drapey sleeve could help drive sales, but distinctive designs like these are easily knocked off, then sold by mass marketers for a fraction of the original's price. That's good for people who shop at places like Zara and H&M. Not so good for designers. Lepore's lost sales to imitators before.
I discovered this lace-up-the-back trick that made it so that we didn't have to make sizes in clothing. But a lot of bigger companies took that and ran with it.
Lepore supports a bill that would give copyright protection to her unique and original designs for 3 years. But Duke Law Professor James Boyle says the bill will have unintended consequences. Imagine, he says, the courtroom drama that could break out over two little black dresses.
The idea of federal judges or juries deciding whether or not they think something looks similar. I mean, can you imagine? The fashionistas will be rolling their eyes.
And even designers at the top of the fashion food chain draw from the zeitgeist. Jennifer Jenkins directs the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School. She says a few years ago, Diane von Furstenberg created an adorable jacket, only
it looked exactly like a jacket made by a small Canadian designer named Mercy.
Von Furstenberg can afford expensive copyright attorneys, but even if this bill passes, Jenkins says smaller shops like Mercy will struggle to prove their work is their own. Congress is expected to consider the bill sometime this year.
Okay, good. Can I have two pattern makers from upstairs today?
Just not in time for Fashion Week. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
And finally, there'll be a surprising accessory on those Fashion Week catwalks. The fanny pack is back. According to the Wall Street Journal, Diane von Furstenberg will start selling a hands-free bag for $325. Prices skyrocket from there. Hermes will sell its version for more than $4,600. It's a far cry from the $7 neon pink fanny pack I sported back in the 80s. Or maybe not. In Los Angeles, I'm Adrienne Hill.
And I wonder if you're going to put a picture on our website of you with the neon pink fanny pack, Adrian.
Not on your life, Jeremy.
Okay. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.